This is David Wilson, and welcome to episode 60 of On Another Track. I'm starting to get a bit of traction with this podcast. The niche I'm in is one of, you know, finding out what challenges people have had in their past and how the hell they managed to sort it out and figure it out like you cowboys do.
And you ride around on your horse all day and you just mull it over in your head. By the time you come home, your head's straightened out. You know what you're going to do. You know what you got to do. Yeah, it's done. The next day you get up and go have fun again.
That's the voice this week of my guest, Terry Grant. He's the original Man Tracker. Welcome along to my podcast series, On Another Track. We're here to explore people and places from around the world. We hear the stories that have transformed my guest's journey and help them get on another track. It's not always pretty, but if you need that practical advice to figure out the roadblocks ahead, then you can't go wrong by learning from other people's mistakes. It's an enlightening experience and a great journey. When you first meet Terry, you're blown away by how straightforward he is. He's a very pragmatic chap, and he's great at finding people. And if you're familiar with the TV series Man Tracker, which has been on the air since 2004, you'll know Terry very well for his tracking abilities. But life was not always like that. He started off in Ontario in Canada and moved across the West in 1975 to find his goal. What's transpired is a life full of richness and variety, and not always any certainty in the future. Listen as he takes us on the journey of the ultimate cowboy against the backdrop of the Rocky Mountains. I started by asking the most obvious question. How the heck did he become Man Tracker?
As with most people, I was very lucky. I was very fortunate. And by accident, basically, the producer went to the Toronto Sportsman Show and he had an idea for a show and a guy, and he was looking for somebody that would make a good man tracker. And he ran into one of my cousins down there who's an outfitter. And he asked him if he wanted to do it. And he said, no, I'm too busy and I don't know how to track people, but call my cousin. He's a cowboy and he's with search and rescue. And so he called me the next week and came out and did an interview. And yeah, that was February. We started filming in May. So very lucky, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, just to confirm, what year was that? Can you remember?
Well, we started filming in 2004.
Wow, all that long ago. So it, as a series, it's been around for quite a while, eh?
Yeah. The last year we filmed was 2010, and then that season aired in 2011. And then it ran for 2 or 3 years after that, quite regular, like every day pretty near. And then OLN, I don't know whether they went broke or forgot where the key was to the door, but They just kept running the same two shows over and over and over. But my understanding was OLN owned the rights to Man Tracker in Canada for 25 years, and they've never shown it again. So I don't know what happened there.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because I was just speaking just before we came on air, and my sideline is driving a yellow school bus, which I immensely enjoy because I have great conversation with the kids. And the last kids I drop off here in Alberta, just south of Sherwood Park, they were talking about Man Tracker being repeated on one of the channels, and they were so excited about it. So, oh, we've got to get in for the next episode of season two. And they were just like, you know, and they said, when I sort of spoke to them, I said, you're possibly coming on the show. They were dead excited. They kind of doubted me a little bit because they wondered, this crazy bus driver, what records people from around the world that are famous, you know?
Yeah, they're looking at you like you're from Mars because, yeah, you're just trying to fit in, dude. You don't know Man Tracker.
I know. And it's little do they know, and little do the listeners know, that I've been taught how to lasso a rope by Man Tracker, guys. And it was great. And my kids. So I can claim to fame there. But the point I was just going to make was that it is being repeated on a regular basis. It must have been syndicated to different channels now. And I know in the UK it's broadcast, Australia, number of places around the world. So it's got longevity in it. But why do you think it has that longevity as a show?
I think just because it's real. We don't add all these reality shows now. They add so much drama and they force it so bad that people just, they don't want to see people yelling and screaming and fighting. They just want to see somebody do their job. And the drama that happens on this show, it just happens. We don't create it. We don't make it happen. We don't push it. It's just me doing my thing. And yeah, you know, shit happens.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you, especially in Alberta, eh? In the last
3 years. Yeah, exactly.
So for people who are not familiar with the show, I mean, a lot of people have heard of Mantracker for sure. But if somebody isn't familiar with the show, set up the premise of the show. So, you know, what is initially happening? How does it kind of work out? You know, where do people start? What's the success rate? Let's look at that as well. But start with the kind of premise behind the show.
Basically, there's two people on foot. They have a map and a compass and somewhere around 36 to 40 hours to get to a finish line. And I'm on a horse and I have a guide, but I don't get a map or a compass. They fire a flare off and then my guide has to get me to the flare site. And from there, we pick up the tracks of the prey and I have to physically track them and try to catch them before the finish line, but I have no clue where that is. So it gets pretty interesting sometimes.
I was going to say, pretty tall order, isn't it, for most people, even an experienced tracker? Yeah,
it can be. Yeah, some of the country does not lend itself to horses. Other types of country, it's a little too open for people. So I get the advantage a little bit sometimes, but not very often.
So you're really relying on a lot of skills that have been kind of learned over the years, I imagine. So where did you kind of pick up those skills as you went along? Because let's be totally frank and honest, you were not originally from Alberta or even a cowboy to start with. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, pretty much. I grew up, you know, in Southern Ontario, and we ended up, my cousin had horses. So we would ride the horses and ponies and all that stuff. And every time there was a rope laying around, somebody would grab it and start swinging it. And then we had a guy that down the road that actually showed us how to do it. So we all got ropes and we were roping everything that would move. And we did learn a little bit about it. And we actually moved some cows for the neighbors on horseback down there. And we got to be known quite well as, you know, three or four guys that could go and move your herd of cows for you. And then I moved out to Alberta in 1975 and I drove out to see the mountains and I'm still here looking at them.
Oh, wow.
So then I learned to become a real cowboy and I did that for 30 plus years and saw a lot of neat country on horseback. And it's just been a quite a dream actually, because it's very few people get to do what they've done their whole life and enjoyed doing after, you know, kind of when I slowed down from cowboying and started to do more other stuff and, you know, let the young guys take over the cowboying.
Yeah.
I still got to do what I've been doing my whole life. And that's kind of where the tracking came in. You're always looking at the ground and following cows. And, you know, if you see a moose track or something in front of you in the spring, you want to be careful and, you know, bear tracks and stuff. And you want to be aware of what's in front of you or around you for animals and stuff. And I've always, you know, had a kind of a passion for looking at tracks and stuff. And I got into search and rescue in about 1993. And then I actually took a course on how to track people.
Really?
And that was just so amazing and incredibly interesting, because the whole idea of tracking people and stuff like that, and the psychological part of tracking people is absolutely mind-boggling. You'd never learn enough. And then the producer came along and, you know, had this idea for a show, and
the rest is history.
Yeah, it's the rest is history. Yeah.
I'm so intrigued by what you just said there. I've got two things I'm going to ask you about. How you become a cowboy is the first part. And then the second part, the psychological aspects of tracking. So let's start with how do you become a cowboy? Because here's the thing, right? Like most jobs, it's not a job board or in a job office or advertising the paper. It's much more organic than that, isn't it, becoming a cowboy? Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes. There's so many things to being a cowboy that, you know, first of all, there's the way of life and the lifestyle and stuff like that. And, you know, a cowboy covers a lot more country than just sitting on a horse and looking at cows and country. You know, you got to fix fence and you got to manage your grass and you've got to feed your cows and know how to feed them and run machinery so you can put the hay up to feed your cows. And then, you know, calving them out and caring for them, being a steward for the land and stuff like that. I was very fortunate that one of the first few ranches I was on, the ranchers were, you know, older and wiser, and they did things at a slower pace, but they got more done than half the other guys. So, and some of them were very, very good at, if I asked them, you know, what is that? What plant is that? They would explain what it is and whether it's native or whether it's a weed, or that was part and parcel of the land management. And then you're, you know, it's a way of life. So, because cowboys are looked at a little differently than most other people, because they spend a lot of time on their own, and, you know, they're breaking horses and stuff. And when you're 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 miles from home and shit goes sideways, you got to deal with it and figure it out, because you still got to get home for dinner. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I think you summed that up so well. You know, they are treated slightly differently, and I think they're actually revered a little bit. They're actually held slightly on a pedestal, which sounds really odd, because the type of work they do is very much on the ground. It's getting in and getting the work done. It's the dirty, you know, sort of slimy messes that you get yourself into. And like you say, some of the situations you get yourself into, you know, most people, let's be frank about it, would not be able to get themselves out of it. So you have to be extremely resourceful, don't you?
Yes, exactly. It's like anything. Cowboys don't make a lot of money. They do it for the lifestyle. And if you're, you're riding a bit of a bronky horse and you're 3 miles away and it starts to buck, well, you really don't want to fall off, because the horse might not stick around.
That's fair
and
to
if
say.
If you do come off, he might be goofy enough. It's hard to get back on. So, and walking long distance in riding boots is just not fun. So you tend to become a pretty good rider, and it's an amazing way of life. And, you know, unfortunately, I think it's kind of dying out a little, the whole aspect of ranches and stuff. You know, I've worked on some ranches that were 30 sections plus, and there's very few of them left anymore.
Oh.
And there's very, very few guys going out and, you know, riding 10, 15 miles before lunch and getting on a different horse and riding after lunch. And it's like everything, the world is moving so fast that there's more done on quads and more done, you know, out of the back of a truck. And it's just the bigger ranches still have to use cowboys and stuff, but there's just very few of them left in Alberta.
It's interesting you say that, because what do you see the pressures on farming here, especially in Western Canada? Why is it now becoming quite rare to find those, other than obviously mechanism has made a big difference because it becomes very convenient. You can jump in and get somewhere slightly faster. But what are the pressures are on farms now here in Alberta, would you say?
As far as the ranchers, they're the same as all the farmers. You know, they're dependent on the weather and, you know, if there's grass to feed their cows and if there's grass to cut for hay. And it's the whole new generation. The older guys that I grew up with and learned from, they had learned that you deal with stuff. You don't run, you know, run over there and fix that and run over there and fix that. It's like you fix this on the way to go fix that.
Yeah.
You pace yourself and you plan. And I think with the younger kids that grew up, it's like, yeah, dad does it the old way. He gets on a horse. I'm just going to take the quad and I'll show him. And the younger generation has grown up that, yeah, just take the quad and, you know, run 3 miles over the hill, throw some salt under a tree and run back home and, yeah, do something else. Well, yeah, that works, but you're missing the whole point of the cowboy and the management and all that kind of stuff. So the quads and stuff are a necessary tool today, but I think they're being over-tooled.
You sum that up so well, because what you're really saying, it's all about the journey, isn't it, with a job like being a cowboy? Because it's not really a job, it's a way of life, isn't it? It's the journey.
Yeah.
And the journey is what feeds the soul, isn't it?
Yeah, and those old guys, you know, they're gone. And the new kids, the younger generation that took over, they don't have that same, they might have a really good work ethic, but they do it different. You know, they don't have that slow, methodical, think about it for, you know, that day and then do it the next day. It's just grab the quad and some stuff and go. And it's a way of life, and it's changing like everything else, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, let's be fair to the youngins. I mean, there are some of them that, you know, go down that route, and they mechanize it, they get things done much quicker. There's probably not the pleasure because they treat it as a job rather than the kind of way of life. But there must be some people that you've seen coming up through the ranks. And, you know, what's lovely about it is we can't, you know, miss the cowgirls as well. The girls are amazing at what they do as well. And I've seen, you know, when I go to the local rodeos here in Alberta, I am amazed at the quality across the board from both the boys and the girls, or the men and the women. So what makes, in your opinion, what makes a great cowboy, a good resourceful cowboy?
There's a lot of different theories on that one. And I'm really glad to see more women getting into this, because, you know, they're just as capable as a man on a horse. They can rope, they can ride, they can look at pasture, they can move cows. And I'm glad to see more and more women doing this, because it's good. Because if a husband and wife can go out, like in the old days, the husband and wife used to go out and move the cows and deal with it. Then they'd come in and, you know, get the house chores done and stuff like that. And seeing the women out and being more prevalent and more in the front of the limelight, I think it's marvelous. As far as being a good cowboy, there's so many things to being a cowboy that, you know, a good one, if you call yourself a cowboy and you can stand up and put your hat on and say, yeah, I'm a cowboy, then there's the work ethic, the morals, the whole ideals that you deal with, you know, and everybody's got their own ideas. And yeah, you know, I'm not going to say cowboys that ride broncs aren't cowboys, because they are. And most of them come from ranches, and, you know, they work on ranches, you know, most of their life, and then riding broncs and stuff at rodeos is basically their hobby. And they're very accomplished at both. So being a cowboy covers a lot of country.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. And I have to say, you know, definitely thumbs up to the girls and the women that are in the industry, because, you know, what I see from them is they are as tough as the guys, and they can do the work. They're amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they look better and they smell better, too.
Well, there is a point there as well, isn't there? Never thought that one, but you're right. Okay, yeah. Listen, I want to just briefly, if somebody was interested in a career as being a cowboy or working on the land or a cowgirl, is there certain channels that you can go down now these days, you know, because, I mean, you did it really organically. You would join your ranch and you learned as you go along, and you learned from the old hands. But is there a formalized way of now going down and actually being educated as well? Because I think that's such a big part now of even just doing being a cowboy or a cowgirl, because you have to think about yourself in the modern world, don't you, and how to market yourself as well, because it's not just about doing the job on the land. You did it. You diversified and you managed to get a break and become man tracker. So is there a formalized way now that people are interested in being on the land can go down?
Not really. There's no school. Yeah, you can take schools. You know, you can go to school and learn about all the grasses and the management and, you know, calving cows and stuff like that. And you can take courses on breaking horses and stuff. But you really have to find a job on a ranch and find somebody that's willing to take a few minutes every day and teach you something and show you a better way of doing something and doing it, you know, and spend a couple of years every day getting up and, you know, catching your horse and saddling it and riding out and looking at the grass and learning what, you know, when a cow looks at you and it puts her head up an extra 2 inches, what does that mean? And, you know, by watching your horse's ears, you can figure out what's going on around you. And you've really got to immerse yourself in it and do it. It's not something you can just do on the weekends and be, you know, a true cowboy.
Yeah, you can't be a part-timer in this. That's the point, isn't it? It has to be a full-time occupation.
Not really, yeah. No.
Okay, listen, I want to sort of circle back to what we were talking about earlier on, because I loved what you said. Psychological aspects of tracking somebody. I thought that was a really interesting statement you said, and I'd love to explore that a bit more, because really, you know, when you are tracking, you're having to use all your senses, as you kind of indicated about horses. You have to sense what your animal's doing. You have to sense what the environment's doing, but also you have to use every sense that you have, I can imagine. So take us on that journey of the psychological aspects of tracking, and what does that really mean in practical terms?
The psychological part is we all do certain things all day long without even thinking about it, and we don't even know we do it. And that's the kind of things that a tracker picks up on. As a tracker, you have to have a really, really good memory, because when I look at a track in during the show, I had 2 days basically to catch them. The whole 2 days, I'm making a profile of that person, what their habits are, what they like to do, what they normally do, and when things are off, why did they do it? And it comes down, part of it is being your right-footed, right-handed, whatever. Things we do in real life that nobody even notices. When we step up on the curb or go up a set of stairs, we'll always start with the same foot. But nobody ever recognizes that. And I've studied myself over years and years, and sometimes I'll be four steps up and I got to back down and figure out which foot I started on. It's like, yeah, it's always the right foot. Coming down the stairs, 9 times out of 10, I start with the other foot.
Oh, wow.
So why is that? I don't know. Everybody curves in the bush. When they're walking in the bush, they'll curve a certain direction. And I've tried for years to figure out why that is. And for me, when you swing your arms, your right arm is kind of hooked to your left leg. So if you swing like runners, if you move your arms faster, your feet go faster. And when you're walking, if you swing your right arm more than your left, your left leg will take a longer stride. So you're probably going to curve to the right.
Interesting.
And things like that I know about people and I've studied and learned, people don't know. They don't recognize it. They don't know about it. And that's all the stuff that I put together. In search and rescue, you learn certain things that people do and profiles. Like, when people cross a river, they'll tend to kind of drift downstream a little bit. When people are being chased by me, normally people will come to a river, and if they're trying to get away from me, they'll run upstream and cross the river, because most people, when they hit the river, will tend to go downstream.
Interesting.
So yeah, lots of the people, if I got to the river and the tracks were a little, suspect and there was no obvious crossing point, I'd go upstream because the prey he's going to think we went downstream. And whatever they think is, reverse psychology on me, they're doing exactly what I know they're going to do.
Oh, yeah.
So there's thousands of things. Like, we never leave a trail at 90 degrees. We'll leave a trail at 45 degrees and we'll go back to the trail at 45 degrees. If there's a trail going the general direction of where I want to go, we'll stay on the trail. And the prey do stuff thinking it's reverse psychology, but it's actually exactly what I think they're going to do. So, all that stuff. And I learned after 4 or 5 years of doing the show, I learned that I needed to treat and track the women differently because they thought differently.
Wow.
So yeah, and I learned that the hard way, but
as we always do, don't we?
Yeah, sex. But it's men, we have that big macho thing, and if I'm chasing two guys, they'll look at a big old willow bush or a really thick hunk of garbage and they'll just bull their way through it. Women will run over, stop, and go, "Hey, there's a trail." And they'll take the trail around it. So, and I've got to think differently when I track women because they think differently. They're more methodical and they don't have that, "I'm tough, I'm a big guy, I can just bull my way through." They don't have that. They're like, they're smart. So I had to treat them different.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, because they're all about kind of survival. They have to look after the family, don't they? They have to preserve the young. And so therefore they have to be much more cunning, I suppose, is the word, in how they think about things.
More commonsensical.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. I didn't realize until you just explained that the major difference between men and women, but you think, well, if in all aspects of life we are different in how we think as the sexes, is there certain things as human beings that we do that are built into our kind of survivability, our kind of fear and flight kind of, part of our brain that automatically makes us do these things? Is that part of it?
No, the people with animals, when they're running from something, you know, they tend to gravitate downhill. And if they come to a river, they just blast straight across it, you know, because they're getting distance between them. The difference with the people is they're thinking. They're always planning. It's like he's thinking, I'm going to go this way, so I'm going to go that way. And that's the big difference with people, is they're thinking about what they're doing, and they're thinking about how to trick me and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, over the 6 years, I think I averaged a catch rate of 70%.
Well, actually, I was just going to ask you about that, and you just took the words out of my mouth. So tell me your best catch, you know, in other words, and also the one that was the hardest and the kind of background. So let's start with the hardest first. Who did you find was the toughest, and did you actually catch them in the end?
Well, all the ones that I didn't catch were the tough ones.
Well, of course, yeah. And which one would come to mind, though? Is there one that really sticks out that was very good at what they did?
God, they all did cool stuff. I don't think there's any one chase that stands out above the rest. You know, all the guys, the ladies and the men that were in the services, whether it was Army, Air Force, whatever, they always did better than everybody else because they could navigate.
Oh yeah.
And that was the big thing, learning to navigate and being able to, and knowing when you go into the bush and you walk for 3 hours, the people that took the training and were in the forces, they could point on a map and say, we're right here, because they knew how far they'd walked.
Interesting. Yeah.
Other people they'd go through the bush and they'd think, oh my God, we've been in here for 2 hours. We must have gone, you know, we missed this little trail. We're way up here now, where really they're not way up there. They're way back there. So they think they've gone farther than they have. And then they come out of the bush on a trail that they think they're on, and it's not the right trail. And then they're really kind of buggered. And that's why search and rescue came about.
Well, it makes complete sense. But what you're really saying is, and this is the sort of stuff that we learn when we're in the Cubs and Scouts, isn't it? You know, that we did all that basic tracking. You know, Baden-Powell had it absolutely right. You know, get people set up so they have the basic skills of navigating, you know, using a compass, a map, you know, figuring out what distance they've gone, look at the sun relative to, you know, the rest of where they, you know, the land and what have you. And I think that you've just summed that up so well, that, you know, if you have a bit of preparation and you learn some of these basic techniques, your survivability goes right up, doesn't it, for sure, and the chances of getting out of a situation.
Yeah.
I got to ask you this as well. Have you ever had anybody double back and start tracking you, and you suddenly realize they're behind you?
We've had a few people that accidentally did that.
Right.
We had Josh and Kyle, I think it was, up in, Northern Ontario, maybe. They had, because Phil was my guide. They had quite a decent head start, and I don't know how much time they got, but it varied with the land. But they got a pretty decent head start, and we got to the start when we were, you know, told to show up, and they fired the flare, and we got there. And then we headed down the trail, and we could hear this noise in the bush, and we'd only gone 100 yards.
Oh, seriously?
And we thought, oh my gosh, there's a moose coming through there, because there was a lot of noise. So we just backed off like 25 yards and waited for this big old moose to come out and scare the crap out of our horses. And here's these two guys walking out of the bush. They looked at us, screamed, and ran back into the bush. And what it was is the two prey had gone, they had actually jogged about 2 miles. And then they said, hey, let's make a big loop and we'll come back in behind the trackers. Well, they did make a big loop and they came out right on top of us because they had like a 2 hour head start.
That's wonderful.
And now, so then they circled back and they were basically 150 yards from where they started out, and I was 50 yards from them. So
that was the quickest catch then?
No, we didn't catch them.
Oh,
no,
you didn't.
We caught them. About 4 o'clock on day two. One of them was caught in the middle of a river and the other one was caught about a mile before that. So.
Oh, you did well there. What was the quickest catch that you ever had?
About 1 o'clock, 1:30 on day two.
Oh, so that was pretty good going then, isn't it? You know,
that was Jordan and Susie. That was over in Quebec, and they were not the fittest people in the world, and they didn't know how to navigate that well, and they didn't know how to read a map that well, and they kept getting slower and slower and taking the toughest route, where I just go around it and wait on the other side. And it was, I think, 1:30 in on the afternoon of day two, and we caught them, and they're going uphill through some kind of open bush that I could run through. And yeah, it didn't take us too long to capture those guys once we saw them. So that was the earliest.
You're halfway through listening to On Another Track with me, David Wilson. Hope you're enjoying the show so far. It's been excellent talking to Terry Grant, aka Man Tracker. Next, I wanted to ask Terry a little bit more about his personal family history and where the Grants came from, and did anybody influence him on the way?
Yeah, growing up in Southern Ontario was unique, to say the least. I started out school in a one-room school, grade 1 to 8, and about grade three or four, the other guy, Rick, and I used to walk to school, and we would take our fishing rods with us, and we'd hide them in the ditch across from the school, because we got out at 2:30. Everybody else had to go till 4, and we'd walk across the road, and we'd grab our fishing rods, go down to the creek, and we'd fish our way home.
I love it.
And so instead of just walking down the road, we'd fish our way up the river. And I don't remember hardly ever catching fish, but we all had fun. And then about halfway through grade 4, we went into Creemore to the old school. They got rid of the one-room school deals, and that ended the fishing on the way home and stuff, because we had to ride a bus. And then when I was about 10, Mom and Dad split up, and we went to live with my grandfather and grandmother. And he was probably one of the biggest influences in my life, because there again, he was an older person. He had worked his whole life, and he did things at a pace that he got a lot of stuff done, but he never ran, never hurried, but he got stuff done. And he was also a gunsmith. And I used to sit out there for hours watching him fix one gun. And, you know, being able to sit there and watch him persevere and try different things, and finally figuring out what works and how it got worked and how to make it work. I learned from a very young age, it's like, if you want to get something done, you've got to stick with it, and you got to be patient, and yeah, figure it out. Though he taught me a lot of stuff, you know, driving a tractor, and every Saturday I'd have to go up and clean the barn and stuff like that. And it was, I learned a good work ethic from him, and the value of patience. You know, you take your time, you get it, figure it out. If this doesn't work, well, try something else. And if that doesn't work, then try something else, and eventually you'll figure it out and it'll work. And so, yeah, he was very instrumental on, you know, me turning out the way I am.
The value of patience. I mean, that is such a virtue that people don't really understand that very much these days. You know, if you're patient, no, it will come to you, won't it, ultimately. But I suppose these days you've got to kind of watch that kind of clock ticking. You know, that's what really kind of drives people's lives, isn't it? The social media, there's time everywhere. You know, we've got these phones with a clock on them. We've got a watch. It must be immensely brilliant to be able to sort of just do what you did as a young kid, you know, grade 2 or 3, go and fish your way home. I mean, what idyllic, really, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, it was pretty cool. It was pretty fun back then.
So, okay, you had this great grounding. You didn't realize it at the time, but it was laying a foundation for you as a teenager and a young adult. So what was the mechanics of kind of getting to Alberta? How did that facilitate itself?
I got my driver's license and a car, and I'd heard lots about Alberta and cowboys and mountains and stuff. And it was like June of 75, and I kind of said, hey, I think I had $75 in my pocket and a full tank of gas. And I said, I'm going to go to Alberta and see the mountains. So I drove out to Alberta, spent the weekend, and drove home.
Are you serious?
And then, yeah. And then, yeah, so I drove for 6 days and spent 3 days in Alberta. And that was June. And then December 13th of 76, I came back out and started work at the Bar U.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, it was a little different, you know, starting there just before Christmas and going through Christmas with no family and friends and none of that around. And so it was, that was the start of my cowboying career there. So,
yeah. And interesting, you were a little bit of a trailblazer. Little did you know it. I think the rest of the family kind of followed you, the brothers and sisters. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. One other sister came out in, oh gosh. Well, grandma and grandpa came out in, oh, holy cow, 82, 83, somewhere in there. And then, one of my little sisters came out, oh, I don't know, the early 90s, maybe somewhere in there. And then my older sister came out, maybe a year after that. So, yeah, there's a bucket full of us out here now. So,
I suppose ultimately, you know, when you look back now, you don't look back. You made the right decision, I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very happy with my decisions. It, I did what I wanted to do my whole life, and I'm still doing it.
Ah, that's wonderful. Okay, well, let's kind of wrap it back around to what you do now, because really, Mantracker was a major part of your life between about 2003, kind of 2011, 12, kind of that range for about 10 years, I imagine.
Yep.
What's kind of happened to Terry Grant after Mantracker? I mean, is the legacy still carried on, and is that spilled over to other ventures that you do?
After the Mantracker show, after we quit filming new shows, I started to do public appearances. And, you know, it was everything from speaking at a town hall with 100 people to I did a university college tour in Eastern Canada where I spoke at, five different colleges in 7 days and actually won an award for that one. And that was up to, I think the biggest one was in Montreal, and there was 750 students in that hall. And it was kind of overwhelming. And I love doing the public speaking thing. It's the getting up there and telling stories about the prey and stories of my life and stuff like that. It's pretty cool because I just opened the floor to questions after about 10 minutes. And you get everything from search and rescue to your horse's name to, you know, the prey and the weather and all that different stuff. And it's always different. So it's fun. So I did that for quite a while. And then, 4 or 5 years ago, the economy kind of changed and shut down my speaking. And then COVID came along and that stopped it altogether. So I got back into doing carpentry about, probably 2015. I got back into doing carpentry, and I've always built furniture and stuff. And then I started to do it for serious. So I built custom furniture in the winter. And in the summertime, I would travel around, do my speaking, do my outdoor shows, that kind of stuff. I wrote a book in 2012, and I would go to different outdoor shows and sell my book and do book signings and stuff at different venues. So that's kind of what I've been doing. And then as the book sales tailed off and the speaking tailed off, I did more and more carpentry and more renovations and stuff like that. So I do that all winter. And now in the summer, the last 3 or 4 years, I've been working for a farmer over by Nanton that I help with seeding and harvest. And I really enjoy that. You know, I've always enjoyed farming and being on the land and, you know, being outside and doing stuff. So that's pretty cool to be able to get to do that again.
And I think you're kind of slightly underselling yourself to be up front here because, you know, you have got your book and I want you to mention your book again. What's the book called? I imagine, is it just called Mantracker or is there a different name to it?
No, it's called Man Tracking, The Ultimate Guide to Tracking Man or Beast. Wrote that and released that in 2012 and it became a Canadian bestseller within 8 months, I believe.
I was just going to say that it's probably available on all good book sites and Amazon. It's still available now. It's not out of print, is it?
I'm not sure if it is.
Is there a chance that you might even look at another book possibly in the future? Is that something that could be on the cards?
I would love to do another book. I've got it kind of laid out and planned. I just need the time to sit down and do it. I want to write a book, kind of an autobiography, but more about the people that I've met through my life that have changed the direction I went, or, you know, made my direction go that certain way. And the people that helped me out, and the people that knocked me down, and how I got myself back up and carried on. And I'd love to do a book like that, because everybody wants to know, you know, what I did in my previous life and how I became Man Tracker, and, you know, being a cowboy, all the stories and stuff that go with it. So.
Oh, they're just wonderful. That's one of the reasons I do this show, is I love, and again, very appropriately, seeing how people get on another track, you know, where they get knocked down, they get back up again, they dust themselves down, and they find the resolve to say, okay, I'm going to take this Y junction or this fork in the road,
yep,
and I'm just going to go for it. And those sort of stories are just gold. They're little gold nuggets, aren't they?
Yeah. You know, bad or good, everybody influences you a little bit on where you're going tomorrow, or how you do something tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a couple other things that I think you've got to string to your bow. The other one I want to just highlight is that you actually, once or maybe a couple of times a year, maybe more, I think, you do a Man Tracker ride. So this is where people can have the experience of coming to the Canadian Rockies for maybe 2 or 3 days and actually really experiencing what it's like to be out there as a cowboy, effectively, or a cowgirl. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. We call it the Man Tracker Ride, and it's going to be in June this year, first part of June. And we do it out of Turner Valley, out at Dewey's place there, the Anchor D. And we basically take 12 to 15 people on horseback into the hills for 3 days, and they get to see some amazing country, and they get to see and feel what it's like to ride through the mountains for 2 or 3 days and do what cowboys have been doing for 100 years. And we sleep in tents, but we have cots and foamies and stuff. All your meals are cooked and everything's looked after. You just got to bring your clothes and dress warm and your sleeping bag. And we sit around the fire at night and tell stories. And some people bring their guitars and stuff like that. And it's an incredible 3 days. A lot of people, after the 3 days, you know, it hurts to walk, because they're not used to riding, and they're just so appreciative for the chance to ride a horse through the mountains and see the stuff that I got to see, and you know, to be able to do something that very few people get to do. And it's pretty cool. The people that I meet there are amazing.
Yeah, and I imagine it's people from all around the world, and it must be very uplifting. It must be quite a spiritual thing in many ways, eh?
It's really cool, because the first year we did it, we had people from Norway, Denmark, Sweden, England. We had a lady from Georgia. We had a lady from Wisconsin. There was a husband-wife team from Toronto. We had people from all over the flipping world, and it was amazing how people, we talk, how things are so different from one country to another, but they're the same.
Yeah.
And it was so cool to learn, you know, the guy from Norway, he was very, very interesting. He ran a company over there, and, you know, we got talking taxes and politics and stuff like that. And it's all different, but it's all the same. And yeah, you meet a lot of neat people. And I know a lot of the people that go on the ride, they stay friends with other people they've met on the ride for years after.
Incredible.
So, yeah, it's an amazing little 3 or 4 days, and it's cool to kind of see what they're looking at and hear their remarks and their oohs and ahs and stuff. And you kind of get to relive the first time you saw that through them again. And it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. It's very cathartic, I imagine. And so let's make sure that people know how to be able to log on and be able to book that. So have you got a website link or something that they can log on to that they can get some information and possibly book?
If they go to Anchor D at anchord.com, it's an outfitter out by Turner Valley. They look after all the bookings and stuff like that. And they'll get a little bit of information about you and your riding habits, and you'll be suited to a horse that suits you. So you're not just thrown on any horse. They will pick you a horse according to your size and your riding ability. And And we try to limit it to 12-year-old and up. They're younger than that, the kids really don't enjoy 6 or 7 hours on a horse and stuff. They'd rather, you know, be back. So
yeah, that's fair enough. And just to explain where Anchor D is for folks that don't know, and if you have a look at a map of Alberta, you've got Calgary in the southern part of Alberta. Anchor D is probably kind of southwest. Is that fair to say? About kind of about 40, 50 kilometers southwest. And you're really on the edge of the Rockies, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, you're right there. It's, we trailer about 10 miles and then we get out of the trailer with the horses and you're right on the very edge of the mountains there.
Beautiful.
It's pretty cool. It's spectacular.
And I have to say, I personally have had experience of visiting Anchor D, and it's just the most beautiful ranch or farm or whatever you want to call it. That is amazing. It's got these amazing, sort of views of the Rocky Mountains. So I would highly recommend it to anybody. And I'll tell you, the bottom line is you can learn how to lasso with Terry Grant. Man Tracker is fantastic. There you go.
Well, you can learn to throw a rope.
Or throw a rope. I don't care what you call it. It was great fun. My kids just didn't forget this. Didn't stop talking about it, Terry, you know, for years.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So we've got, what you've got coming up in June. So that's June 11th, 12th and 13th of 2022. Make sure you book that, guys, because you will not look back. And I think you'll probably be oversubscribed after this podcast goes. I'll almost guarantee it. Also, one other thing, and I might embarrass him here, actually. I might embarrass Terry here. I think you do a bit of modeling, don't you?
Well, I've been known to do the odd commercial here and there.
Fair enough.
I don't really model anything yet, but yeah, the opportunity's there. I'll take it.
So if you were looking at the crystal ball for Terry Grant and Man Tracker, what does the next 5 or 10 years look like?
Well, honestly, I hope it doesn't change. I enjoy doing my woodworking in the winter. I enjoy ice fishing when I want to go out and it's nice. I enjoy working for the farmer for the spring and fall. June, July, I've got pretty much off. So I take the boat and go fishing. I go do a bit of golfing, do some golf tournaments and, you know, celebrity appearances here and there. And I hope it just continues on because I love my life right now.
Oh, that's so wonderful to hear that, man. And I mean, I have to be perfectly honest with you. Living in northern Alberta where the temperatures tend to be a little bit colder, I get very jealous of your great lifestyle down there in southern Alberta. It's wonderful. It really is. But it's a nice jealousy, I promise.
Good.
And okay, so what I'd love to just finally sort of finish with, and this is something that I really enjoy asking my guests, and it's amazing some of the answers you actually get. But if you were 18 again, what would you tell yourself?
Ooh, knowing what I know now? Holy cow. Don't change a thing. Just keep being yourself. Do what, get the job you like. You don't have to like the job you get. I've had some jobs where, cowboying wasn't a full-time thing because I did a lot of welding and I've worked in factories and stuff like that just to make ends meet when cowboying was slow. And if I was 18 again, I wouldn't change a thing. I might make better decisions on a few vehicles I bought, but yes. other than that, I don't see very much that I'd change.
Oh, wow. That is so wonderful to hear that because, you just decided you're going to plow a furrow and that furrow is pretty straight. You're going for it, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to be a cowboy and I got on a ranch and I learned to do that. And then a year later, I'd go to a different ranch and then, I'd leave there for one reason or another. And I never turned down very many opportunities. Like I say, I went welding for 2 or 3 years and that was a case of, I didn't have a job and somebody said, they're looking for apprentice welders. So I thought, hell, why not? So I went and I did that for 2 or 3 years. And then I went from there, I went straight back down south, found a job on a ranch and started ranching again. And it's, the welding is always something that you can use when you're working on a ranch or a farm or anywhere. And I never really turned anything down saying, oh, I don't want to do that. Why would I ever need to do that? I said that about geography class in grade 10, 11, 12. It's like, I don't need this geography. What the heck am I going to do with this?
That's a laugh, isn't it?
And now it's like, I've traveled across Canada and a whole bunch of the states and the Yukon and Northwest Territories and stuff. And geography is so cool now. It's, you know, there's so many diversifications as you drive across Canada. There's 20 different types of terrain and stuff. And geography is pretty cool. And now as I get older, I find history is even more interesting. So yeah, when you're 12, 14, 16, geography, history don't mean squat, but now it does. So it's cool how life changes, eh?
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. Well, listen, you know what? I really appreciate you giving up sort of an hour of your time today, because I know it was pretty tough to get us together and we had a good laugh at the start of the show, but you know, it's been really good to speak to you. And I don't really get the chance to do these in-depth chats with you, because, you know, when we do often meet, is the rest of the family there and there's all sorts going on. But what's wonderful about it is I love the authenticity. I love the way that you actually say, you know, being a cowboy or a cowgirl is a very good career, you know, if you really are determined to have that different pace of life and be back in, you know, an organic job, something that's on the land, because it's still to be celebrated, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because becoming a cowboy or cowgirl now, it's getting harder, you know, to be, you know, in the truest sense of the form, but it's still a lifestyle, and it's a type of person. It takes a special type of person to be a cowboy. And a lot of people, they fail miserably. They call themselves cowboys, but yeah, they fail at it terribly, you know, for one reason or another. And a lot of it's the mentality of the cowboy way of life and the cowboy demeanor and all that kind of stuff. So it's good to see new cowboys coming up, for sure.
Yeah. And it takes a definitely a state of mind to sort of say, you know, be determined, carry on, you know, they're going to be the tough times, but what you ultimately get out of it is it's a way of life that is very rare these days, especially when you look at the whole world as an entity.
Yeah.
But it does give you something that is going to set you up so well for the rest of your life. Eh?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, Terry Grant, a.k.a. Man Tracker, you know, I want to just thank you so much for giving up an hour of your time today. It's been an immense pleasure to speak to you as ever. And I wish you the best of luck with your rides in the Rocky Mountains on June 11th, 12th and 13th of this year. And also get that book out. I'm dying to see that book.
I have a hard time sitting still long enough to do stuff like that. So it takes quite a while for me to get a page written.
What they say about writing a book, isn't it? You got to turn up every day at least.
Yeah, exactly.
There we go. All right, Terry Grant, Man Tracker, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure. Take care.
Thanks, David. See ya.
You've been listening to On Another Track with me, David Wilson. My guest this week was Terry Grant, the ultimate man tracker, helping you get your life on another track. Remember, there are more conversations coming up in this series. Just look out for On Another Track with me, David Wilson, on your local podcast platform and subscribe. This has been a BritCam production for Urban Aspect Incorporated, keeping us safe on the roads of North America.